It is the year 1986. Sydney Morning Herald has run an explosive story about rampant corruption in Indonesia. The headline, After Marcos, Now for the Suharto Billions. Now, the author of that piece, Australian journalist David Jenkins, was kicked out of the country. The Australian government then had to navigate a very rocky time in this important bilateral relationship. David Jenkins has always been fascinated by Suharto, the former Indonesian leader. He first met just a few years into his presidency in 1969. He's just released book one of a three-volume series on this man, a brutal dictator. A book that reveals Suharto's poverty-stricken childhood, his early career in the military. Jenkins says, if you want to understand modern Indonesia, you must understand General Suharto. David, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
That 1986 story, that was quite the event.
Well, it doesn't go away, does it? But no, it was a complex time, and but here we are still discussing it. But at least it's well in the past now.
Well, your gloves were off. You even referred to Madame Suharto as Madame 10%. That's not going to make you a popular chap.
No. Well, I mean, that was what Indonesians were saying and so on. And the Indonesians had been growing increasingly angry at that stage in 1986 about corruption and some of the perks and lurks being given to the Suharto children. And there'd been a conference, in fact, in Melbourne about Australian-Indonesian and PNG relations, the triangle, as it was called. And it was really noticeable that prominent Indonesians who were there were just incensed by the latest toll road concession. And they said, look, this is really, it's just gone so far, too far. And so it was very much a live issue. And I think it's for precisely that reason that Jakarta overreacted perhaps, and also perhaps the headline could have been a bit more delicate. It was basically a feature article that was to run on page 14 or something, and then it was firmed up into a news story.
Oh dear!
So yeah, these things happen.
Tell us, I mean, the character of the place in the mid 80s. I mean, we'll go back further than that a moment, but Indonesia at that time, how would you characterize it?
Well, I'm not probably the best person to speak about that, because I'd been banned in 83 after I'd published a book about Suharto and his generals, a study of Indonesian military politics over the previous 6 or 7 or 8 years.
You have a checkered record.
Yeah. So the ban began in about 83 or whenever, 84, I guess. And and then it continued. It was reinforced after that Sydney Morning Herald article. So it was 10 years altogether. But I had been there. I'd been first there in 69. So in effect, it's been, you know, about 50 years or something now. Goodness.
Let's go back to that, 1969. And what an extraordinary place. And you were in the, as I understand it, same street as the Suhartos and various other rather colourful characters. I mean, tell us, locate us. Give us the sense of geography.
Well, it was in my predecessor had from the Melbourne Herald had rented a house in Jalan Rasamala, a street in Menteng, a leafy suburb, as they say, in near the heart of Jakarta, and the house was 300 metres from the Suharto house, and on the corner, exactly halfway between the two. The two houses, my house and his house, was a house in which was living a man called Raden Darsono, not a Sudirjo, who had been one of two co-founders of the Indonesian Communist Party in 1920. And he was still alive, still living, because he'd long since renounced communism.
He'd met Lenin.
Yes, he'd met Lenin, he'd met Stalin and Trotsky, and he'd been present when Trotsky got stuck into Stalin, And so had his co-founder, Samawan, who was also back in Jakarta, both having renounced communism. So they knew the Russian leaders. They knew Samawan knew Mao Zedong, who helped arrange boat passage from Shanghai to Bangkok when he was on the way back. So there were a lot of interesting people around. General Nasution, one of the key generals, was living very close by as well. So it was an interesting place to be.
It's a very sort of Graham Greene neighbourhood that you'd moved into. The imperative for you, though, was to get access, and you achieved this first with Madame Suharto. How did that happen?
Well, I mean, I can't remember exactly how it came about, but I had just arrived and my predecessor and I overlapped only very briefly. He introduced me to one of the co-founders of the party, Communist Party, which, of course, had been torn apart a few years earlier with 500,000 people killed. So it was an unusual situation, to say the least. But I didn't know anyone else. I'd been going to Southeast Asia for 4.5 years. I'd been there 6 times, to Vietnam and all the other places. But I hadn't been to Indonesia. And so I set out to write interview five people and write feature articles. And they all went off. I sent them off to Melbourne and with photographs, the whole kit and caboodle. And the editor said, "Oh, no, we'll run them one a day for the next Monday to Friday, but you must produce an interview with Suharto." And Suharto wasn't in the habit of giving interviews, least of all to striplings from the Melbourne Herald. But fortunately, having a chance to meet Madame Suharto, by great stroke of luck, an interview was arranged on the Sunday. And the editor of the Melbourne Herald, I think, thought that he just had to click his fingers and people all around the world would jump to his attention.
Editors of the Herald have a habit of being that sort of person. So you got the interview. Was he... did he reveal all? I mean, how did Suharto strike you?
Well, he was visiting. He was opening an exhibition down in Bogor. He'd just recently been involved in the campaign to wrest West New Guinea from the Dutch, and he'd been played more of a role than anyone except Sukarno in achieving that end, although it didn't come to fighting in the end. And so he was opening an exhibition about West New Guinea, and we sat out under a ringan tree, a banyan tree in the grounds of the palace, and he spoke carefully, but he was open and friendly, and he deftly turned away any questions that he thought were a bit too sensitive, a half smile on his face as he did so. So it was a welcoming environment, and his wife was there, and all the Indonesian press corps floating around at the palace, but... He made 2 points that were of particular interest. One was he wanted close relations with Australia, but what also came through very strongly was that he was very bitter about the Chinese. He believed that the Chinese government had been involved in or knew of the coup that led to the murder of half a dozen senior generals. And in fact, that bitterness remained for a long time. Indonesia and China relations were frozen for about 23 years.
You're a new arrival, and here meeting this man with this country in his palm of his hand. What was your sense then of the nature of his regime?
Well, I think we knew that there'd been horrific killings in late 65 and the last 3 months of 65 and into January 66, 500,000 communists or alleged left-wingers murdered, massacred by the army he controlled and by civilian vigilantes, Muslims and some Christians and others. And it was a terrible time, and in the mass killings, particularly in central Java and east Java and in Bali, where it was exceptionally brutal. So I think we all knew that, and it was hard to sometimes square this affable, smiling general, as he was known, with these actions that he'd taken. But there was never any doubt that he gave the signal, and never once, I think, showed any indication that he regretted what had happened.
Which is very, you know, this is recent history. I mean, the events in this country of that sort of distance are still have the capacity, I think, to colour our current politics. And I think you would argue the same is true in Indonesia.
Yes, yes. And it just, as the years went by, and I was very fortunate because I'd gone there when I was quite young. I had, you know, over 50 years either living there, only for 5 or 6 years living there, but constantly going there. As a journalist, and had a chance to meet various people and maintain links with them. And it struck me that I was asked to write a book about his life some 15 years ago. But the more I delved into it, it struck me that we already knew a great deal about the 32 years he had in power. And what was really lacking, perhaps, was a detailed analysis of the 44 years that led up to that. And for 25 of those years, he was an increasingly important army officer and engaged in, in all sorts of activities in West New Guinea and Konfrontasi with Malaysia and so on.
Before that, of course, and this takes us to the first of your three volumes, Young Suharto, you write that he was a man hardened by parental neglect.
Yes.
What's the story there of those early years? What made them so challenging?
The relationship between his parents was not good, and his mother abandoned him when he was 40 days old and went into hiding and left him, and he was raised by a great aunt and then was settled in with her. But when he was 4, the mother came back and took him back for a while, but then he was farmed. His father kidnapped him and took him when he was about 9 to stay with other relatives 50 miles away. So it was a very disrupted time. And there's no sense in his memoirs of any particular love for his mother or father, and some irritation perhaps. But in other places, he clearly shows warmth of feeling for his aunt who raised him and various other people in his life.
And then into the military at the time of, still the tail end of colonial rule. What sort of a soldier was he?
Well, he didn't have many prospects at all. I mean, the key thing about Indonesia was you had in the late Dutch colonial period, the Indonesian elite could send their children to very good Dutch primary schools and Dutch high schools. There are about 24 very, very good, exceptionally good Dutch high schools, which carried people through to tertiary level, and there were a few university faculties in Indonesia. No university, but faculties of law and medicine and so on. And so the elite, the people who came to become who became the political leaders of Indonesia, almost all came through that stream. And they'd either studied in Dutch in Indonesia or in the Netherlands itself. Suharto is a village boy, goes to a village school, and then has a very mediocre education. And there was a great resentment on his part that he felt an outsider, rejected, looked down on by the other officers, but joins the Dutch colonial army just before the war and does well, and then joins the Japanese-sponsored Indonesian Self-Defense Force and again does exceptionally well. And I had the chance to talk to a number of Japanese officers who trained him and knew him well. And they'd only been 26 when they were training him, and they were still alive in 1999 and going strong. And he's obviously a man of great exceptional abilities, even though his education was very poor.
Well, and adaptable to circumstance as well. I mean,
so. Yeah. Well, exactly. And I think the problem was that General Nasution, I'm one of the 7 officers targeted for assassination at the time of 65 of the coup, allegedly by the communists, was the man in charge as Suharto got near the top. But he made a decision that people with Suharto's level of education would never get to the top jobs in Jakarta, the staff command jobs there. The staff jobs, but the command jobs out in the field, commanding troops, he could have that. And that's what he got. In 65, he was not a senior officer in Jakarta. Well, he was a senior officer, but not at the critical staff level, and unlikely to get to that level. But then the others were killed, and he seized the moment, used his command of troops to wrest back control, and quickly emerged as the dominant figure.
Does his presence linger in contemporary Indonesian politics?
Oh, I think definitely, yes. I mean, nobody really investigated seriously the killings and the other thing, and abuses, and what happened in Timor and so on. So the army gathered round and wanted to ensure that he wasn't brought to trial and so on and so forth. As Indonesia's gone through periods of difficulty, there's been some nostalgia for that rule, because it was a time of stability and impressive economic growth and so on. So, but I haven't been there now for a couple of years, I don't know what the current feeling is. Yeah, I'm still back writing about 1948 at the moment.
the first of three. It's quite a task that you've set yourself.
Yes. Well, it wasn't planned that way. It was just, as I say, there were 44 years. He was 44 years old when he seized the moment, took charge, and rallied the army and the nation around him, or the anti-communist forces, which were very strong. The Muslims and the Christians and all sorts of middle-class people and so on had been very worried about the communists. Then the 32 years in power, 30 of it as full president. But as I say, the early years are very revealing, and so many people were willing to talk, very frankly, people in Indonesia, people in Japan, people in the Netherlands who knew him or followed the developments at that time were fighting there, and it just seemed there was so much good stuff there that was going to go to waste and remain unknown if somebody didn't try and pull it together.
Well, David, bravo. You have done just that. Congratulations. and thank you for sharing the merest scraping of the top of that iceberg for us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Australian journalist and historian David Jenkins, and former Foreign Minister Gareth Evans is going to launch David's book, Young Suharto, The Making of a Soldier, via Australian National University tomorrow morning.